From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Long before Martin Short did his impressions of Jerry Lewis on SCTV and Saturday Night Live, and long before he created the character of Ed Grimley, Short hosted an imaginary TV variety show in his bedroom. On today's Fresh Air, The Martin Short Show. Also today, we talk with detective writer Lauren Esselman. His hero, Amos Walker, is a tough private eye in a tough town, Detroit. And we have reviews of the new jazz album from trumpeter Tom Harrell and of the TV miniseries Lonesome Dove. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Martin Short grew up kind of obsessed with show business. He was able to turn his childhood fantasies into a career as an adult. In his years on the comedy shows SCTV and Saturday Night Live, he became a one-man cast of showbiz characters. He created Jackie Rogers Jr., the albino lounge singer, and Irving Cohn, the elderly songwriter who's always in the middle of some anecdote about the old days. And Short perfected impressions of Jerry Lewis and Katharine Hepburn. But the character he became most famous for was a homebody, the manic and indecisive Ed Grimley. Last fall, Short developed a Saturday morning animation series for NBC TV called The Completely Mental Misadventures of Ed Grimley. Since leaving Saturday Night Live, Short has starred in the movies Three Amigos, Inner Space, and Cross My Heart. He's now co-starring with Nick Nolte in the new comedy Three Fugitives. Nolte plays a notorious bank robber who's just gotten out of prison. While Nolte is innocently at a bank making a deposit, Short busts in with a stocking on his face and stages a totally inept robbery. For protection, he takes Nolte as his hostage, and when the cops see Nolte, they can't believe he's just an innocent bystander. Martin Short, as the clumsy fugitive, gets to walk into poles, trip over himself, and do a lot of physical comedy. I asked him if he learned how to do physical comedy before he started acting professionally.
I think that physical comedy is something that you just have. When I was a little kid, I remember there was a neighbor across the street who used to make these lemon tarts for us. We didn't much like them, but she thought we did, and she was very sweet to make them. So my parents were out front, and they said, you know, go over and get the tarts from Mrs. Jameson, you know, and I said, okay. So I went over, and I was like nine, and as I was running across the street, I deliberately tripped and landed with my face in the tarts, and they would laugh, and I knew that it was like the easiest, fast, you didn't have to write, really, to get a laugh. And I think that some people can just do it. I think that also what was interesting for me to work with Francis Weber, the director of this film, was that I don't think that there's anyone who directs physical comedy better. And it is really actually very tricky and complex to make it correct, physical comedy, the way you shoot it, the way you edit it. You can't make yourself, you look, it has to be real, but you can't look like you're really injured, and it's a fine line.
Ever hurt yourself while practicing?
No. I once was doing a piece in SCTV called Jerry Lewis Sings Dylan. Lewis Sings Dylan. And I was on top of an eight-page kind of podium, and I was in this bad outfit, and I was singing, "The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wah!" And at the wah, a big wind was blowing, and at that point, all my clothes got ripped off, and I was just there in my underwear, polka dot, of course. But there were little strings attached to all my clothes. Well, they pulled, and the Velcro didn't go. So I went flying through the air and landed on my knee, which I'm still.
I shouldn't be laughing.
No, it was okay. But that was not out of me screwing up.
Right.
It was out of me foolishly writing that piece.
You know what you were just saying before about how when you were young you used to buy the lemon pies from the neighbor and you'd purposely trip and land with your face in the pie on the way home, make everybody laugh. When you were young, did you try to make your life into a sitcom as much as possible?
No, it wasn't that. It was just a sensibility in my family. I am the youngest of five, and everyone was funny. I mean, everyone was very funny. My brother Michael has won two Emmys for writing SCTV. He's 6 years older. Comedy was very normal in our family. Do jokes was to be normal. Insult each other was normal. it was an Irish family that could have bursts of anger and then be gone in 1 second. It's very interesting. I have this like opening of Christmas gifts from 1966, a tape that I put on when I was a kid, and I heard it this year, you know, and I was amazed. It was like a mental family. It was like screaming and shouting, and then laughing within the next second. No particular rhyme or reason to it. And so comedy was very normal.
Martin Short is my guest, and he stars in the new movie, Three Fugitives. Let's talk about some of the characters that you've created. Let's start with Ed Grimley, who you're still doing in animation for Saturday morning television. Who was the character based on? Was it based on a type of person, someone you knew, or was it a part of yourself that you imagined yourself being?
I think it's all those things. I mean, there were a couple of people that aspects of the character were based on. One was a guy I knew in high school who kind of talked like this. His voice would go up. Oh, his hobby was taking pictures. And he said, "Oh, I've taken some wonderful slides. You should really see them." And so that kind of quality. Then there was someone else that kind of talked like that. So I kind of put the voices together, and the enthusiasm for life, I guess, is an aspect of my personality. Ed is like the ultimate heart attack victim who has survived. You know, he just can't. He never did stop smelling the roses and being amazed at how wonderful life is. Everything is fascinating to him. If the phone rings, you know, he'll say, before he answers it, he'll stop and ponder, "Isn't the phone wonderful? There's always such a sense of mystery, I must say." You know, and it becomes very kind of a fascinating adventure to answer the phone. Well, in a way, it is. We just tend to be a little more jaded. So he developed in Second City stage, and I would do him around the house.
He does this great, he has like two different dances. There's the like I'm nervous dance, in which he puts one hand on his forehead and dances around in this really kind of uncoordinated fashion. And then there's the I'm happy kind of dance that he does. Where does that come from?
I don't know. I just, you know, I just do these dances, I guess. There's not much thought put into them.
Did you do these as a kid? Did you dance around when you were happy or nervous?
Yeah. I haven't changed that much.
You still dance around when you're
happy. Since I was
nervous.
A kid. Again, with these tapes I have. I used to tape a lot when I was a kid. My brother used to say that I was going to take the first 30 years of my life, listen to it, and then die. That would be, yeah. But my wife, Nancy, will listen to a tape when I'm 15 and be stunned at how similar it all sounds and seems. And you know, she's someone who will say that, you know, she's, who was she when she was a teenager? Is she the same? You know, she's gone through different aspects of her personality, and it seems like there's a constant.
Did you ever see yourself as the kind of nerd-like character that Ed Grimley is?
No, I never really thought of Ed as a nerd. You know, when he first became popular, they would always refer to him as a pointy-headed nerd, you know, and I was just skiing in some valley, and I kept thinking, you know, if I died, the headline would be Pointy-Headed Nerd Plummets, News at 4. But, no, I never thought of him as a nerd. I thought of him as this strange character living very contently in a life, you know.
What's it like to watch the cartoon version of yourself in character as Ed Grimley?
Well, when it at the beginning, it was unsettling because I didn't feel that they had the animation together yet, and in fact, they didn't have the animation yet together. It was still kind of, it was like early Mickey Mouse, you know. And then, like anything, the first year of any series is a learning curve, and everyone improves. And the main thing you want to see is that learning curve happening, going up, and certainly by show 3, 4, you could see they were getting moves and they were getting the character. Then we started, they would actually tape me doing the script and send it overseas. And that was an enormous, you could really see the improvement. Now they were getting it. It's a hard character to animate because it's so based on improvisation. There's nothing set.
Martin Short is my guest, and he stars in the new movie, Three Fugitives. Let's talk about Jackie Rogers Jr. A great character. This is this...
it's very... Now, let me say something about you. That that you like Jackie is very revealing because, you know, there are two camps on Jackie. People either find him totally, I mean, just hate him.
Oh, really?
Or they love him.
Oh, I love him.
Like the cast at SCTV, most of them didn't like Jackie.
Really?
Yeah, they thought it was just kind of grotesque. And we'd write these pieces, Dick Masucci and Paul Flaherty and I would write these pieces, we'd take them in the read-through and they just kind of die, you know. But because the cast trusted me, they let me do it. And but I always liked Jackie. Rock and roll musicians tend to like Jackie. You know?
Well, I like Jackie because he's so extravagant and so show busy.
Yes, he's also the most self-absorbed character that I've ever done. I mean, I did a special a couple years ago.
He's a lounge singer for any of our listeners who don't know.
Who's also albino.
Yes.
And cross-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
His long white hair. And he once wrote a book based on life with his father, Jackie Rogers Sr., and it's titled Damn You, Daddy Sir. It's a bad laugh, too. That was the laugh. It's kind of your tongue. It's like a little dog with the tongue through the teeth. Anyway, Jackie's most self-absorbed. In a special I did a couple years ago, I had him thrown out the window by kidnappers. And he fell through the air, smashed through the top of a truck, landed in the cage of a lion. And as he was getting up, looked at his hands and said, gee, I never noticed what tiny hands I have. So it's like that kind of absorption that even that kind of terrible fate wouldn't affect him.
I think it's fair to say that one of his anthems is She Loves Me.
Yes, it was his dad's song. You know, she loves me and my amazement. I love her. What the heck does that mean? Nom, 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 nom.
That's a Sheldon Harnick song.
Yeah.
He also wrote the lyrics for Fiddler on the Roof. And
right.
This is from the show She Loves Me. How did you, I think Jack Jones had the hit of it. How did you choose that song as the perfect showpiece for Jackie Rogers Sr. and Jr.?
I don't know. I used to go into the writer's office at SCTV, and I'd always be like, she loves me under my amazement. And they'd say, you should do a piece on that. And this is 1982, and I kind of said, well, I don't know if this is an old subject matter, you know, lounge singers. But then I thought that I would do a short piece, a two-minute piece, on this character, Jackie Rogers. And if I had him die at the end of the piece, then it would be no problem repeating Turf. So we wrote a piece called Jackie Rogers, Old Mother Nature, She Loves Me, which was supposedly something that had been done in 71, and Jackie Rogers had been killed while doing it. Whilst doing it, as Ed would say. And they were finally releasing it 11 years later. And at the end, I needed in a little circle, someone to pop in and say, you know, watch the show. So I invented Jackie Rogers Jr., who was a white-faced albino, to pop in the circle and say, you know, I miss my dad. I hope you won't. Thursday's at 11. And then about a month later, Eugene Levy wanted to do a piece with Bobby Bittman, his comic character, and Jackie Rogers. And I said, well, you're going to have to do the son. He said, well, no, I want to work with the father. I said, well, the father's dead. You know, we can't say now he's not dead. He said, well, bring him back. I don't want to work with that albino. But he did.
Now, you started off doing musicals, and I think you even had a cabaret act before you started doing
sketch comedy. No, I never
had a cabaret?
I used to do cabaret shows.
You know, okay.
What's a nice country like you doing in a state like this? Stuff like that, you know.
Did you want to be a
singer?
The
Apple Tree. Yes, I wanted to be Frank Sinatra.
You did?
Senior.
Right.
Yes.
Right. You know, I saw you sing, the one time I actually saw you sing seriously was on your HBO special, and
right.
you ended the show by singing Noel Coward's If Love Were All.
Right.
Not, yeah, If Love Were All. Yeah.
If Love Were All, yes.
And Paul Schaefer accompanied the piano, and he
Fabulously.
Insisted, he
yes.
made it really clear he'd never heard this song before. So here you were singing seriously, and I liked the way you sing. I never heard you did it before. But I was thinking a lot of people in the audience must be waiting for the joke, because no one's used to hearing you sing seriously.
Yeah, it was actually an unusual thing to do, probably, to do that. But, you know, it was interesting. I wanted that show to be a kind of a conglomeration of what my career had been, and that was certainly a part of it, you know, that I had been a singer. And it was interesting when you think back on how many, especially if you're a Canadian actor, how many different avenues your career can take you on. You know, and in Canada, you really do everything to live. It's like England. It's less, you work more and there's less of a star system.
Well, one of the things that you did, you, I believe, hosted a top 40 rock show in Canada called Right On?
Yes, in 1973.
What was your persona as host like?
It was sad, really. It was, I had long hair, but I had no rock and roll feel at all. So, you know, I'd say, thank you, and stuff like that. And I think I hurt myself, you know. And it was live on CBC, 5 o'clock. Television, and I had no cue cards, and I would have to sing, you know, step into my life and feel real. I mean, you'd have to, and if I was like, it was, I'd have to sing the top songs of that week. So if it was like Al Green, I mean, I would have to impersonate him basically. Sit right down. It was just bad, you know, and I had these three fabulous backup singers who judged me because they clearly should have been hosting the show, and why was I? And, I would forget lyrics and make them up all over the place. You know.
Why were you hosting the show? I mean, you were really more into Frank Sinatra than rock and roll.
Well,
right?
It was a job. It was a job. I think it was paid $250 a week, mind you.
No, I mean, why did they hire you?
Oh, I was in a show, Godspell, and I was kind of, energized. I don't know. Foolish them. They. I could sing, and they thought, well, that's good, and he's kind of personable. They just made a mistake.
Was there any choreography on the show?
No, there was no choreography.
I ask this because in some of the SCTVs where there's like the chorus of male dancers and a
yes.
production number,
the you Jewel were sometimes Hallmeyer dancers.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And you are sometimes in the chorus. And I figured, oh, this is like some kind of weird fantasy of
no,
yours.
No. I never want to be in the chorus. It's too kind of in the chorus. But certainly what was the best part of doing SCTV in the tradition of Second City was that sometimes you were the lead in a piece, and sometimes you were in the chorus of a piece, but it was a company working together.
So do you want to sing straight now? I mean, would you like to be able...
No, I actually have no desire to sing straight, only because I think that it is a stigma. They are waiting for the joke, and if they're distracted that way, it doesn't work. It's hard to become... It's very difficult to do what you've satirized. It's very hard. And it's best not to. I would love to. Now, I mean, a dream is to do like a fabulous Broadway musical, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Where you're playing a character, that's different.
But I guess...
Martin Short to come out and sing, you know. What now, my love? I'm better doing Bobby Short than Martin Short.
Martin Short is my guest, and he stars with Nick Nolte in the new film, Three Fugitives. And we'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Martin Short is my guest, who I'm sure you remember from Second City TV, from SCTV, and from Saturday Night Live, and from his movies, including Inner Space. He has a new movie. It's called Three Fugitives, and he co-stars with Nick Nolte. We talked about some of the characters that you created for a sketch comedy. Let me ask you about one of the impressions that mm-hmm. you did, and that's of Jerry Lewis. I think you're really good at it because you know physical comedy, and you can capture the kind of goofy aspects of Jerry Lewis, but you also get the kind of dark side, the bitter side, and the ego of the man. What interests you in Jerry Lewis?
Well, I think initially as a kid, because he's a huge influence, would be the comedy. I mean, as a kid, seeing The Delicate Delinquent, which was my favorite, I just found it so funny. He was so funny to me. I think, again, maybe keeping in the idea that maybe comedy is often best. I mean, I've never done stand-up, and so
right.
verbal banter is not intrigued me as much as is interaction, but also surprising the audience. Never, you know, constantly giving 90-degree turns. And Jerry, who would suddenly go, "Wah!" you know, at the top of his lungs, always, it just made me laugh because it was so mental. Finally, you know, but then when the other aspects of the personality start to crop up, well, that's even more fascinating because it's like a kind of fascinating painting that you can do without it being obvious. Again, as surprising as the scream is the other aspects of the personality.
Do you see Jerry Lewis, in a way, as being a cautionary tale about what could happen in show business, the way an ego can get out of control?
Well, I don't know. I don't like to, you know, I don't want to judge anyone.
Okay.
I think that in general, it's best not to take yourself overly seriously.
How do you rehearse to do him? Do you steady him before doing him?
I would start singing. Gotta get my old tuxedo pressed. Gotta smile, hold notes, and shake. And I tell you what a joy and a thrill and all good stuff. You know, you just kind of... I would suck a lozenge, imaginary lozenge. I don't know why. It's not like he does a lozenge. But it's just an idea of, you know, an attitude. And sometimes you just hear people. It's like music, you know, you hear it and you just kind of get the placement in the voice or the throat and nasal. Or Robin Williams, very kind of like that. You know, God, that happened, there's more back there. You know, so you just kind of play.
Have you heard from any of the people who you've done impressions of?
Well, Robin's a friend of mine, so he finds it very funny. And Jerry Lewis said that he found it very funny.
That must have been a relief.
Yes, it was, because you don't want to irritate someone that you admire. And Hepburn, I don't think she stays up late, that late, or cares.
Martin Short is my guest, and he stars in the new movie, Three Fugitives. Now, I've read about you that when you were young, you used to do an imaginary TV show in your room that would run on alternate weeks in your imagination with the Andy Williams show.
Yes, that is very true, and we were canceled too, finally, which is a tragedy. Hullabaloo, I think, replaced us. Yes, I used to, it was 8:30 Mondays in my mind.
Right.
And we'd tape ahead, you know, we'd have shows in the can. And I'd type things up for TV Guide, you know, highlights Marty will sing. And I would come out, and I had a Frank Sinatra, the Sands album, so I used that as an applause record. And then, you know, I'd use intros from albums, and I'd have a guest, you know, my guest would be Tony Bennett, and Tony would come out and say, forget your troubles, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand. I'd sing another song, I just don't remember the words, you know, and he'd be my guest, and then I would, you know, sing with him, you know, with the record, and then I'd go to the applause, and I'd, you know, piece it together, reel to reel. And then I would take, you know, the Playboy of that month and do the interview with Eldridge Cleaver or something, and, you know, I'd sit and you say that we're not moving fast, and, you know, and I'd then read his part, and then I'd end with a medley, and then someone would call dinner, and we'd tape later.
Did you sit on a stool and sing like Perry and Andy used to?
Oh, sure, yeah. But sometimes I just throw that stool aside and belt out a big final.
Because that's the kind of informal guy you are.
There was no one restraining me.
So who were your sponsors?
Boulevard Watch was a biggie. And the Kraft people.
they did.
No cigarettes even then.
They did Perry Como.
Yeah. Kraft. Well, I know. They were very generous to help me out as well.
Why, if you were doing an imaginary show, would you have it alternate every other week with Andy Williams? Why not be on every other week?
How could I do my films?
Every week, I mean. What?
How could I do my films?
Oh. Yes.
Remember,
yes,
I was directing as well.
Now, when you were doing these shows, were they serious in your mind, or were they parodies of the show? I mean, were you doing them for real, or were...
No, it was real. I had a fantasy world that wouldn't quit, you know? I mean, I would... If I got on the back of a bus, I would go... If I got on a bus, I would go to the back of the bus, where the windows were kind of oval-shaped, you know, so that I'd have more of a sense of riding in a limousine. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and if I looked out the window, or I'd pretend I was, you know, on an airplane taxiing off, and fans had, you know, this is at 10. I was just intrigued by it. It wasn't something, it wasn't like Rupert Pumpkin, or wasn't it?
Rupert Pumpkin, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't that sick, you know. It was clearly a fun hobby. You know, it was... fun. And while other kids my age were protesting, you gold to have a revolution, I was up in my room singing, weather-wise, it's such a cuckoo day, you know. But certainly in no way did it become something that I, you know, would answer to two different names or anything.
Did your imaginary show have a theme? A song?
No, there would be a production number, you know, kind of opening, which would be similar, where dancers come out and go, Marty, it's time for Marty. But, I mean, that wasn't a real theme.
Oh, what a nut.
Yeah. Sad, huh?
I think it's great. When you were young, you obviously had all these show business fantasies in your head, and you imagined yourself being everybody in show business, the hosts of the shows, the guest singers, the interviewers, probably the dancers as well. Could you explain why you were so caught up in show business when you were young? And what did show business mean to you when you were young?
Oh, I think it was, why was I caught up on it? I don't know. I mean, certainly my family were fascinated by it, so you get it from your family. Not overly, though. Not as much as I.
Well, your mother was a classical violinist.
Yes, she was.
Show business.
No, but still, we all watched the Ed Sullivan Show. We all watched these shows, you know. I think that obviously there was something brewing inside me that wanted to perform and wanted to, that from an early age, I knew like the man who knows from an early age that he wants to be a doctor because he cuts open a little frog and just stares at it when he's five. I was whipping a fry pan cord as a mic. When I was eight, around the house.
So now that you're really in show business, making movies,
yes,
and
I am.
Doing comedy, yeah, the real thing. Does it measure up to? Is it everything you hoped it would be?
Oh, it's great. It's odd, you know, when your fantasies become your reality, then you are out of a fantasy. But it generally is fabulous. I have a fabulous life. Certainly, it's work, though. I mean, that's the reality. The first job I had in Hollywood was a show called The Associates that I did, the Jim Brooks show that I did with Wilfred Hyde White, and this is 1979. It was about lawyers, and it was very, actually, well-written, done show. And the first week, it was done in Paramount, and I'd walk around Paramount and say, this is Paramount. Look at it. Look at that. There's the sky painted blue. And then by the second week, it was, I got to go to rehearsal. I don't know. What is this script? My character isn't developed this week. You know, and it was back to worrying about, and I could have been back in Toronto doing something for the CBC. It was just about the work, suddenly.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank
My
you so
pleasure.
Much for your time.
Great to be here.
Martin Short co-stars with Nick Nolte in the new movie Three Fugitives. His animated TV show, The Completely Mental Misadventures of Ed Grimley, is on NBC on Saturday mornings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Tobias Wolff. His new book, This Boy's Life, is a memoir of his childhood. After his parents divorced, Tobias lived with his mother. Tobias's brother, Jeffrey Wolff, has written about growing up with their father in his book, The Duke of Deception. I hope you can join us.
You might even hear a whole gang of cheers just because we're together. Weather-wise, it's such a cuckoo day. You just say those words and we'll take our birds down to Acapulco Bay. It's so perfect for a flying honeymoon. Oh, babe, come fly with me. Let's fly, let's fly. Pack up, let's fly away. And don't tell your mama.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Private Eye Amos Walker knows what it's like to ride in a cop car, to be at the scene of a murder, and to be knocked out cold. Lauren Esselman has had those experiences too. Esselman writes the hard-boiled Amos Walker novels and is a former crime reporter. Coming up, Esselman compares the work of detectives and writers. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Stories, the new album from Tom Harrell, a trumpeter who's played with Horace Silver, Bill Evans, Sheila Jordan, and others. And television critic David Bianculli previews Lonesome Dove, starring Robert Duvall in Larry McMurtry's story of the end of the Old West. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Disbarred attorney Joel Steinberg late today was convicted of manslaughter in the beating death of his illegally adopted daughter, Lisa. A state jury in Manhattan reached its verdict after deliberating for 8 days. Conviction on the charge of first-degree manslaughter carries a maximum sentence of up to 15 years in prison. A hearing to decide Steinberg's sentence was set for March 8th. The judge in charge of the Iran-Contra case today ruled that President Bush will not have to testify at the upcoming trial of Oliver North, but that former President Reagan might. Details from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
Judge Gerhard Gesell quashed the defense subpoena for President Bush because, said the judge, Oliver North and his attorneys had made no showing that Mr. Bush has any specific information relevant and material to the 12 charges still pending against North. While the judge refused to quash a similar subpoena for Mr. Reagan, the judge made it clear he will not allow the former president to be called to the witness stand without substantial reason and without further hearings. Moreover, Judge Gesell ruled against the defense request that Mr. Reagan be forced to produce all his personal diaries for inspection by the defense. The bottom line of the judge's order is that President Bush will not have to testify at the North trial unless there is some dramatic production of new evidence, which seems unlikely. And although the judge has ordered President Reagan to remain on call to testify, the judge has also made it clear that Mr. Reagan's testimony will not be compelled unless it is really necessary. That necessity is something Judge Gesell is clearly skeptical about. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Former Representative Jim Jones today pulled out of the race for chairman of the Democratic National Committee. The announcement leaves former Jesse Jackson aide Ron Brown as the only candidate. Jones, who described himself as the only moderate in the race, was the last of Brown's four opponents to end his campaign. The Democratic National Committee votes February 10th on a new chairman to replace Paul Kirk, who is giving up the job. Brown will become the first black man to head a major American political party. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega has announced a government-sponsored social package that includes capitalistic economic policies to combat the country's soaring hyperinflation and falling production. But in today's speech to the Nicaraguan National Assembly, he failed to offer the major redrafting of the country's economy that many observers expected. David Adams reports.
President Ortega opened a 2.25-hour speech before an extraordinary meeting of the National Assembly with a passionate attack on past U.S. policy towards Nicaragua. But now that the Reagan administration has left office, he said, new conditions for economic change existed. Nicaragua's record levels of hyperinflation, now over 30,000%, and falling production, require drastic corrective measures, he said. And, he added, there would be a heavy social cost to pay, especially in terms of unemployment. But Ortega's speech left many in the audience scratching their heads over what these drastic measures would entail. While announcing an estimated 40% cut in state spending, he failed to describe where these cuts would be made. And most confusing of all, he referred to the incorporation of capitalist-style economic measures without explaining how these might apply other than in a reduction of state intervention in the economy. For National Public Radio, this is David Adams in Managua.
Lebanon's rival Shiite Muslim militias today agreed to end more than a year of fighting. Leaders of the pro-Syrian Amal and Iranian-backed Hezbollah have signed a peace agreement mediated by Iran and Syria. Negotiators say the pact could help gain the release of foreign hostages now held in Lebanon. Stock prices were slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose just over a point to close at 2324.11. Advances led declines 7-5 on volume of 168 million shares. Average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 12 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz trumpeter and flugelhorn player Tom Harrell is known for his solid mainstream playing. For the past 5 years, he's been a member of alto saxophonist Phil Woods' band, and before that, he recorded with pianist Bill Evans and singer Sheila Jordan. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of Harrell's new album, his first on a major label.
In jazz, as in any art form, critics like to draw parallels between a musician's life and work. So you read a lot about the joyful exuberance of Louis Armstrong and the urbanity of Duke Ellington. But sometimes, focusing on the ties between a musician's life and art can be misleading. These days, articles about trumpeter and flugelhorn player Tom Harrell make much of the fact that he suffers from schizophrenia. The neurological disorder is triggered by a chemical imbalance and makes Harrell appear withdrawn on stage. According to the liner notes to his new album, Stories, on the Contemporary label, Harrell can concentrate on only one of his five senses at a time. The challenges he faces are sure to attract curiosity seekers to his music. But Tom Harrell's solos are nothing if not cohesive, each phrase growing out of the one in front of it. And his compositions reflect a variety of moods, like the writing of most any mainstream jazz musician. Listen to Tom Harrell on his flamenco-tinged waltz, The Water's Edge. The way Tom Harrell blends his flugelhorn with Bob Berg's tenor sax is orthodox hard bop. But bassist Ray Drummond and drummer Billy Hart sometimes give the rhythm section a rockish feel without getting heavy-handed. The pianist is Niels Landoki. Harrell designed his album to focus on his side folk as much as himself. In fact, the first solo on the record belongs to Bob Berg on Harrell's tune Rapture. Bob Berg's playing with Tom Harrell is more inspired than his work in Miles Davis's band a few years ago. Davis's jazz funk seemed to restrict him. This rhythm section kicks him from behind. The band's hard edge is intensified on three tracks where John Scofield plays electric guitar. Maybe he was under-rehearsed, but Scofield sounds a bit disorganized on a couple of tunes. Here's part of his solo on Tom Harrell's Story. John Scofield's scattershot solos work to the music's advantage. They offset the leader's carefully fashioned lines and broaden the music's emotional range. There's nothing really new or different about the materials Tom Harrell uses, but oddly enough, that's part of this music's charm. He takes thoroughly picked over ingredients and still comes up with something fresh.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Tom Harrell's new album Stories on the Contemporary label. This is Fresh Air. For urban edge and macho color, nobody tops Lauren Esselman, according to a 1986 Time magazine article on crime writers. Lauren Esselman sets his hard-boiled private eye novels in Detroit, not far from his home on the outskirts of the city. Esselman grew up in Ann Arbor and has always lived and worked in Michigan. Since the publication of his first novel in 1976, Esselman has written 28 books, including several westerns. He's best known for his Amos Walker mysteries. Esselman's latest book is a collection of 10 Amos Walker short stories. Here's Esselman reading a short excerpt from his story, Fast Burn.
Going to see a private investigator isn't like visiting the dentist. I come at the desperate end of the long line of friends of relatives, friends of friends, and guys around the corner whose friends owe them favors. By the time the potential client gets around to me, he's admitted that his problem has grown beyond him and his circle. So I let this one resign himself to the last stop before the abyss and didn't realize until I looked up again that I was playing host to a dead man.
There's usually a lot of characters at the end of the line in a detective story. Do you think that the detective genre is a good genre for pessimism and hopelessness?
It is that, and I think it's one for optimism, too, depending upon the detective himself. In this case, Amos Walker is a guy who realizes that it's a pretty shabby world, pretty dirty world, and he's just trying to keep his own corner of it clean. So I think he himself represents hope.
Does that describe your temperament at all?
I like to think that, at least on a good day. You know, on other days, I think I'm part of the shabbiness, but I hope most of the time that I'm keeping my corner clean.
Have you or anyone you know ever used a detective?
I never have, and that's a very good question. I've never been asked that question. There's no one I know who has been a client of a private detective. I've known several private investigators, but that's a very good question. I don't think I've ever met anybody, at least no one who ever told me, that they themselves had ever used one.
I guess I find it kind of curious that so many of us are interested in reading detective stories, yet it remains literature to most of us because we haven't had any direct experiences with actual detectives.
That's true. They're there, and every now and then you can pick up the yellow pages and sometimes flip through and come to the investigation section, and you find lists of these people, and you find out that nearly every community of any size has a fairly large complement. So obviously there's business for them out there.
There's lots of competition now in the literary detective world. When you started writing the Amos Walker novels, did you think about how you would want to make him different from the other detectives?
Yeah, kind of. And at the same time, I knew I had a good foundation in that I had never done it. And one writer is different from all the others. No matter how much he might try to sound like the others and imitate his heroes, he's going to sound a little bit different because he's basically a different person. So I knew I had that to fall back on. But also I had the background of Detroit, which at that time had not been used for this kind of thing ever. And it had been used, of course, for police procedurals and crime stories and exploitation novels and movies, but never for the quintessential hard-boiled American private detective genre. So I knew I had those things going for me, and all these things came together. And if he's different, it's because it's a different person writing them from anybody else.
You know the expression that detective novels are about a hat, a coat, and a gun?
I've heard it.
Yeah. Well, I think it was Pauline Kael who said that she thinks they're really about a hat, a coat, and a typewriter, because the detective novels are so much about description and observation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's true?
I think so. And I don't know that they're that different from the rest of literature for that. I do know, too, that some of the best writers working today are working in the detective field for that very reason, because they deal very heavily with the senses, and it's sensory detail that touches people when they read, and the very best writers put you as close to being there as you can possibly be.
I assume that you read some of the other detective novelists who are writing now, and in one of your novels, Sugartown, Amos Walker picks up a detective novel and doesn't much like it. I just want to read what you wrote about that. You write, "There was nothing on television, and I sat up for a while smoking and trying to read a paperback mystery I'd picked up in a drugstore once, tailing someone. It was about a private eye back east who wore expensive running shoes with everything and squawked so much about the things he wouldn't do that you had to wonder what people hired him for in the first place. His partner was a professional killer, and if there was a mystery to it at all, I couldn't find it and gave up. To hell with PIs with codes they have to keep hauling out and looking at like pocket watches, and to hell with cool, fresh voices in women's mouths. They never match the faces. I put down the book." Who were you thinking of when you wrote that?
Oh, I was opening fire on Bob Parker.
I thought so.
And his character Spencer there, obviously. I like Parker's work a lot. I think he's one of the best detective writers working, but I never got close to Spencer. He always struck me as a bully and a snob, and the problems I have with him are the ones that are pretty much laid out there. I worry about a man who says he's honest and then has to remind himself what he has to be honest about. I think that a truly honest man, his honesty is something that's neither spoken of nor even thought of. He must be that way without even thinking about it. So I opened fire on it a little bit. This is nothing new. I understand that Raymond Chandler used to poke fun at Mickey Spillane and things like that. It's a little inside stuff every now and then. I try not to get too carried away with it, but I'm dealing with a character who's existing in something like the real world, so I'm going to deal with some of the competition as well.
Well, one thing Spencer and Amos Walker have in common is that they both like jazz singers and they both like torch singers.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's your taste, too.
Yeah, I find that when talking about Walker's likes and dislikes, it's easier for me to give him mine. That way I don't have to go back and check and find out whether or not he likes this or doesn't like
that. You used to be a crime reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Which came first, writing detective novels or being a journalist?
Being a journalist, although I was a journalist by way of becoming a novelist.
Uh-huh.
When I was in college, I was told by one of my mentors, one of my journalism professors in college, that I mustn't count on making a living from my fiction right away, and that I should have something to fall back on. Therefore, I chose journalism, and it was all to the good. Everything I learned from journalism is still doing me good. But along the way, I've written just about every kind of writing that can be done, with the exception of pornography.
And why didn't you try that?
It made me blush. I could not write a sex scene without blushing. I still can't, which is why when I get my hero and a heroine anywhere near a bed, I pan out the window. I call this the Faith Baldwin School of Writing About Sex.
Have you ever been knocked unconscious?
Yeah, once. I used to box when I was in college, and I got a rabbit punch behind the head. And that's what I think I may be, as far as I know, the only working detective fiction writer who has been knocked unconscious, with the exception of Dick Francis, who was once, he once had a horse step on his face, and I don't know another writer who can claim that.
Yeah, I mean, I asked about this because Walker gets knocked out on occasion, and you have to figure out how to describe it.
Yeah, and he gets knocked out enough that I have to describe it different ways, different times. The first thing that happens when you come to after being knocked unconscious is you vomit. And usually in fiction you don't see that, but Walker does do that, or he's fighting it back or something like that. And that happened to me certainly when I came to. It's not a pleasant experience. Sometimes I'll get him through a book without beating him up or drugging him or getting him arrested or hitting him over the head. But at the same time, I don't think he's any more real than he is when something's being done to him. That's the time when you most sympathize with him. But if I did it too much and all the time, then he'd become a figure of fun. But every now and then I feel sorry for him and I let him get through a book without being hit on the back of the head.
I can think of something in common that you must have with the detective that you write about, and that is one of the things he does in the morning every day is check the mail to see if any checks have arrived. And mm-hmm. as a writer, you probably do the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you check, you put the bills in one pile and the checks in another much smaller pile, and that's the way you see how you're doing. You take everything that doesn't say final notice on it, and you file it under the blotter.
So how are you doing?
Doing pretty well. I think I'm pretty much keeping neck and neck here.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Lauren Esselman spoke to us from public radio station WUOM in Ann Arbor. Another Amos Walker mystery, Silent Thunder, will be published in the spring. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hi, welcome back.
Thanks, Robert. What's coming up on the show?
Well, we'll hear why President Bush will not be testifying, it now seems, at the Oliver North Iran-Contra trial. We'll also be hearing from a doctor, California doctor, one of the first to treat many AIDS patients, on how the doctor-patient relationship might be improved. And we'll also be hearing from Fred Friendly, the professor of journalism at Columbia, former head of CBS News, who produces those seminars for public television. A series of them is just beginning now. It's actually an academic ethics course. It's very good. It's a combination of sort of the Joseph Campbell interviews, remember,
mm-hmm.
and Hollywood Squares. I think it's a merger of the two ideas. He says, with a good panel, a chimpanzee can moderate. I thought you'd appreciate that.
Yeah, hey, let's give it a shot. Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. You can generally recognize a miniseries by its epic pretensions and sappy score, but television critic David Bianculli says Lonesome Dove is different.
Two of the TV forms that almost nobody has faith in anymore are the miniseries and the Western. Viewers don't seem as willing to commit to the effort it takes to watch a miniseries these days, and the Western, well, name the last really good one you saw on television. I'd have a problem answering that one myself. It'd probably be Have Gun, Will Travel, and that's going back 25 years. It's much easier for me to identify the next really good Western because it starts this weekend on CBS. It's called Lonesome Dove, it's based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning Larry McMurtry novel, and it's a miniseries. Lonesome Dove is the story of three former Texas Rangers who tamed the Old West but don't have much to do in the new civilized West. Two of them run a small cattle outfit outside a tiny Texas town named Lonesome Dove. And when the third ex-ranger shows up after a 9-year absence talking about the beauty of an untamed land called Montana, they decide to mount the first cattle drive aimed at that faraway territory. The miniseries Lonesome Dove is the story of that journey and of the people and places they encounter along the way. If the story, as I've described it, sounds a little thin to be worth 8 hours of viewing time, that's because I don't want to reveal any of its treats or twists. Viewers should take the Lonesome Dove journey just as these former Rangers did, without knowing what lies ahead. It's not ruining any suspense, though, to say that of the many reasons to watch Lonesome Dove, the biggest and best of them is Robert Duvall. He plays Gus McCrae, who owns the cattle outfit with Woodrow McCall, who's played beautifully by Tommy Lee Jones.
Gus.
What?
Why not go up to Montana? It's a cattleman's paradise to hear Jake tell it.
Sounds like a damn wilderness, if you ask me. And we're a shade old to start fighting Indians all over again, don't you think?
I mean it, Gus. Why not just go north with the herd?
I tell you what, you ride on up there, clear out the Indians, build a little cabin, get a nice fire going in the fireplace, and me and Jake will gather a herd, and then we'll come on up.
I'd like to see the herd that you and Jake could get. Herd of whores, maybe.
And those two actors are only the tip of this Western iceberg. Other stars include, ready? Angelica Houston, Diane Lane, Robert Urich, D.B. Sweeney, Danny Glover, Barry Corbin, Frederick Forrest, and, in the best role of his life, Ricky Schroeder. The scenery is astounding, the cattle drives actually look like cattle drives, and before Lonesome Dove starts sounding too wholesome to be fun, it's scattered with scenes of very brutal, very believable, and, though this sounds terrible, very entertaining violence. Give credit to Larry McMurtry for writing a magnificent epic, to Bill Whitliff for adapting it, and to Simon Winsor for directing it. The actors are wonderful, Duvall, Jones, and Angelica Houston especially, and only a miniseries could have given them and this story the room to work. It's a thrill to see a miniseries that takes advantage of the form and develops all of its characters and surprises viewers in a way no weekly series can match. In Lonesome Dove, there are no guarantees about who will live or die. Death comes quickly and unfairly, just as it did in the Old West. It's ironic in a way, but that approach to death is what helps Lonesome Dove bring the Western and the miniseries back to life. Don't miss it.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Well, we chased out the Indians, didn't we? Hung all the good bandits. Has it ever occurred to you that everything we'd done was a mistake? Me and you done our work too well, Woodrow. Hell, we killed off most of the people who made this country interesting to begin with, didn't we?
Nobody in their right mind would want the Indians back. Or the bandits, neither one. Hell, fire.
Well, Woodrow, if you like civilization so much, what are we doing riding off to the wilds of Montana?
We ain't riding off to the wilds of Montana right now. If you'll recall, we're in San Antonio looking for a cook.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we phone up Dial-A-Song and listen to some of the latest music by the group They Might Be Giants, and we talk with the two members of the group, John Linnell and John Flansburgh. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Johnny Otis, the R&B performer and club owner turned minister who now showcases top R&B singers in his church. And book critic John Leonard reviews Martin Bommel Duberman's new biography of Paul Robeson. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.